Good afternoon. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and today I'm so happy to have Melba Joyce Boyd here in the studio. Melba, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for you know, braving the traffic, you know, 94, 96, take your pick.
Really? Yeah.
And thanks also for choosing the music, like the soundscape for today's program to go along with your voice and your poems that we're going to get to hear, too. Okay. Thanks for being here. And we've got Jason behind the glass making things sound good out there as we come to you over radio waves and the ether. Melba Boyd is now the Michigan Poet Laureate. Melba, how many months have you actually been laureating?
Laureating. I got the invitation end of January. I got a phone call from the Library of Michigan. And kind of ever since then, things have been going on, you know. So I've been, they're really starting just, you know, to rev up. Like, did a reading at a library in St. Clair Shores. And I did a short reading at the Michigan Humanities Poetry Out Loud. That's for high school students who, you know, do recitations of favorite poems that they have. And they asked me to come and read some poems. And then at the Michigan Notable Book Awards, I was introduced. I think that was my sort of formal introduction. And that was a lot of fun because I knew quite a few of the writers who were being honored. So that was really cool. That was at the Library of Michigan, again in Lansing. Uh-huh. So things are happening. And
you just retired from Wayne State University.
Yeah, I did.
In December,
exactly.
So no rest for the weary? Or what's the expression? You're not weary. You don't look weary to me.
Well, let me put it like this. I became or pursued the profession to be a professor because it was the only realistic way to make a decent living and have time to write. So, and it did work. And it was a compliment in the sense that what I wanted to do as a professor of English and specifically African-American literature and African-American studies. So, and of course, I'm a literary historian, film critic historian, and filmmaker around literature and writers. So everything that I was doing at the university was really tied into my work as a writer. So it was a good, really good connection.
It all fed each other.
Yeah, exactly. Because poetry is not something you pursue if you're trying to be wealthy. You know what I mean? Like my mother said, you should go to law school.
Right.
Okay, so.
And you actually signed up for the LSAT, right?
Yes, I did.
And was that after your master's, after you were at Western Michigan for your master's too? Okay.
Exactly. It was after that. But I realized while I was studying, I don't want to be reading this for the rest of my life. Okay, so. But I was also working for Dudley Randall as his assistant editor at the time. So I was deep into poetry, editing poetry, and then because of Mr. Randall, I was writing more and more poetry. So
at Broadside Press.
At Broadside Press, yes. So
you started doing that in 72, was it 1972?
1972, exactly.
And you had just graduated with your master's, were doing it.
I had finished all my coursework, and the only thing I had to do was to prep for my oral exam. But he hired me that summer, and then I had morals, and I was finished. I finished a degree.
Oh, and quick shout out to Broncos.
Oh.
Go Broncos.
Absolutely.
Because then the story turns to Go Blue, eventually.
Eventually, yes. In fact, when I was in high school, I was recruited by Michigan. My counselor, Michigan, came to the high school. I went to Pershing High School in Detroit. And there were recruiters who came to the campus and met with the counselors. And I was one of the students that my counselor recommended. And I was just like, yeah. But the thing was, it wasn't far away. I wanted to go away to college. Ann Arbor's not away. Ann Arbor is like down the road.
Right.
So I wanted to feel more independent and to have to take more responsibility for myself. And I knew a couple of students who were at Western at the time that I had, you know, that I knew from who had gone to Pershing and from my old neighborhood. I had also gone to Southwestern High School before we moved on the other side of Detroit. So I thought that was a pretty cool place to go. It would be different. And hardly anyone was going to Western. Everybody was going to Eastern, Wayne State, you know, Michigan State, you know, maybe Michigan. But
you defined some of your politics at Western.
Well, let's say politics defined me. It was the times. It was the times. I graduated in 1967. That summer was the Great Rebellion in the city. That shook me up a little bit. Didn't affect the neighborhood I was living in because, you know, Detroit is a very large city. It's one of the largest in terms of area of any major city in this country. Seriously, it's 139 square miles. And so I wasn't threatened or whatever. In fact, before it was even sort of, you know, quelled, my family left. We were taking a trip to Montreal, so we weren't even there. Yeah, that's much Montreal. But 68 was a very active year politically on campus. And when Dr. King was assassinated, everybody was grief-stricken. And there had been a plan by the Black Action Movement to have some kind of a demonstration because we wanted to have Black Studies courses in the curriculum. But when Dr. King was killed, we decided we were going to do something right now. And so the next day, we had our demonstration. We took over Student Union. And fortunately, despite the possibility of disaster, nothing bad happened. It was the same year as Kent State. But the Students for a Democratic Society, we were inside the Student Union, and they literally set up a buffer between the National Guard and us and some
Thank
of the professors.
For SDS.
Yes, yeah. Yes, yes. So I think they were like, oh, wait a minute, that these was Black students. Yeah, but we here, right? And but the head of the Board of Regents for Western told the president of the university, don't send anybody in there, ask them what they want. And so
that sounds reasonable.
Very reasonable. He says, what do we want? And we're like, oh yeah, what do we want? So
quick.
Yeah. And that was one of the things we were planning to ask for anyway, but also we asked that we're able to send representatives from the student organization to King's memorial service. And, you know, and I was a freshman, you know, I was just a little chump sitting over here and, you know, the older students were running everything. I was just there. But it
important
was
important to be there.
It's very and important.
No,
it
but
important.
As you speak about it, I mm-hmm. can see it's the visual of it. Mm-hmm. It feels is very vivid for you still.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So vivid. I remember, called my mother, on the payphone because it's 1968. There's no cell phones. Okay. And we were all standing in line to call our parents to let them know we were okay. And my mother, she was really very funny. She was just like, well, I knew you'd be in there. It's like, Yeah, I am. I'm here. I'm okay. She just said, be careful.
Well, because your mom was an activist too. She became a lifeguard to make changes.
She was. I think what's interesting is my mother would have never used that word in particular. I think she loved swimming, and she grew up in Alabama, and she was very much aware of what. Living in a discriminatory situation. She was born 1927 in Bessemer, Alabama, and her father was a labor activist. And so she just would go, her thing was this, what's right? So she had a very interesting story because when she was in high school, she had the black kids had to swim in the creek, and so they had to beat the snakes out the water and stuff like that.
And they're like poisonous snakes,
exactly,
in the South.
Exactly, exactly. So her brother and my grandfather, taught her how to swim. And then, so one day, when she was a teenager, she went down to the city office, recreation office, and said, well, this is 1944 or something like that. And she's like, well, when do the colored kids get to swim? And the guy said, because, you had separate but equal, right? So that's the way a lot of, you would approach things at that time. And he says, well, when you get a colored lifeguard. She's like, okay. So she goes to Tuskegee and she gets her lifeguard certificate. She's a, physical education major. And she comes back and she says, well, we got one now. It's me. So he had to figure out times when, the color kids could come and she was the lifeguard, but she was a big activist of women and sports and equity. And she was public school teacher in Detroit. She was the first woman athletic director in a high school. And she was really pushing equity. Her programs were written up in the Title IX for the state, and all of this when all this was going on. So, but she wouldn't necessarily call it activism. She would just say that's what she's supposed to do,
and it's what's right.
Yeah, what's right. This is what you're supposed to do. So, I just think it's more of the climate of being in Detroit, very progressive city. Very progressive, black community. And so there was support for it. There was, and it was a place where you could actually make change. Mm-hmm. And she transferred from Tuskegee and went to Wayne State. She married my dad after he finished his degree at Tuskegee, and then they moved to Detroit, and she transferred to Wayne State. So she finished her degree there. Yeah.
And it's so interesting how you've also... You've built your life here. Like, you've gone away as well, teaching in Iowa, the Fulbright to Bremen, Germany, but this area, the Detroit, mm-hmm. is this region, the city, mm-hmm. The state is, mm-hmm. It feels only natural. You're Michigan Poet Laureate.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I have traveled all over the world. And I've done readings and, all kinds of, and been published. My work's been published, translated into German, and now it's being translated into French. And it's appeared in those languages and in journals and stuff.
Maybe Japanese soon, too.
Well, I don't know if I'm going to make it to Japan. I was supposed to go to Japan at one point, and it conflicted. But when I was leaving Iowa to go, and my students hated this when I was teaching in Michigan, they hated me when I was saying, because I taught at Ohio State for a year. And they would always, when I would introduce myself, I taught at Ohio State, and they would go like, boo. Right. And I said, but you got to understand. Ohio State paid real well, okay? It was the truth. It was the truth. They gave me a serious raise over what they were paying me at Iowa. So, and it got me closer to Detroit. So, because that was a long drive from Detroit to Iowa City.
It is a long way.
Yes, a long way. So, but the experience of having read and engaged scholars and poets, writers, Germany, France, England, Italy, Spain. I mean, North Africa and China. I actually did a visiting professor at Fudan University's in Shanghai. And that was also quite amazing. And it was a very good climate as an American to be there because it was 2009 and Obama was the president. And they, the citizens, at least, I don't know about the politics of it, but the citizens were very excited about Obama being a president of the United States because they felt like this could mean better relations with the United States. And they were very happy, very excited. And it was an amazing experience because it was not, it's nothing you can imagine. You have to go there. I mean, the city, it's Shanghai. It's a historic city to begin with, right? It was amazing, super modern. I mean, I was just, whoa. You just can't, what they don't let you tell you and what you don't know about China from what we get through the media, it's just like, no, nothing like that. Taking a super train to Hangzhou to do a poetry reading at the university there, it was very futuristic in a lot of ways.
Yeah. It must have almost felt like space travel. You were going so fast.
It did. It did. It was weird. I was just like, wow, I wish we had some of these.
Yes. Some infrastructure like that.
Infrastructure like that. Exactly.
Safe and more economic.
Absolutely.
And better for our world.
All of that. But the thing more so was the appreciation for Black American literature. That the students that I was teaching, in English, obviously, and they were, totally fluent in the language. And the writers, I was teaching literature with film. And what I started at U of M for my dissertation was on a relationship between film and literature, okay, and how you can use literature to teach some of the nuances of literature with film, because you'll have actual visual metaphors are there, and the ideas, your literature, the setting is 50, 60 years ago. They don't know what's going on in 1920s America, and certainly not in a Black community space. For them to to see that, it helps them to also read the literature. So I was doing that there, but what blew me away was that they had not, seen the films. Like I did Richard Wright, I did The Color Purple, I did my documentary on Dudley Randall and his poetry and all of that. They knew all those writers. I'm like, really? Oh yeah, The Ballad of Birmingham, which is Dudley Randall's probably most famous poem he's ever published. They said, oh, no, we learned this poem in English class, when what we would call, their eighth grade. And I'm like, okay.
That.
Yes.
Because they weren't just preparing because they had seen some of, the syllabus.
Uh-huh.
They had had this from a young
age.
They knew
who these prominent Black American writers were. And some of the students, students here in the... Oh, sorry about that. Some of the students in the U.S. and even in Detroit won't know who they are, and that's tragic. But that the respect and of the culture and the writers as a part of world literature was just okay,
and that's something that you were building with Dudley Randall in the broadside press.
Sure, exactly.
And it started in 1965.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. With that exact poem, actually, Ballad of Birmingham. He wasn't, at the time, not see himself as a publisher, but he published it so he could protect his rights as the poet, because there was a songwriter, Jerry Long, who wanted to adapt the poem to music. So it was coincidental that then, and he called it Broadside Press because it was a broadside. And then subsequently, he started publishing other prominent Black American poets, Robert Hayden, Margaret Walker, just he was motivated to do that. And then from there on, he started doing publishing the books.
It feels like he was so vital for the Black arts movement.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And you too.
Well, I don't know. I was his assistant and I was learning a lot. And it was just by chance that he hired me. The reason I applied was because I was going to apply for teaching at the Detroit Public Schools, right? And there was, they weren't hiring. There was a freeze on hiring for whatever reason that summer. And so I had studied all of those Broadside books, you know, when I was in grad school at Western. So I said, well, you know, I got a master's degree. I'm going to go see if I can apply to be a work for him in an editorial capacity. And so I just went to the office where it was, a little bit teeny-weeny space. I didn't expect that. In my mind, it was like in a big business, you know.
Right. Well, because of the largeness of what it was, the importance of what it was doing.
Exactly. And so I met with him and...
You just knocked on the door. You had no appointment, right?
No,
you just
no
walked
appointment,
in. I love,
you know,
this.
And I went in, and a young lady was there at the counter, and I said, is it possible for me to see Dudley Randall? She said, yeah. I thought he wasn't going to be there. I'd just leave my name or number. And she went back, and he came out, and I was like, oh, my God, that's Dudley Randall.
quick, what am I?
And so I told him, you know, who I was, what my credentials were, and did he have any positions open, you know, in editorial? And he said, well, you know, I really can't afford to pay you what I should for your education, blah, 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 your expertise. And I said, yeah, but, you know, I don't have any job with all this expertise. I just want to work, and I figure I could learn, and I would work for nothing. And he said, no, people should be paid for, you know, for their labor. You know, he's a big labor guy too. It's Detroit. Come on. So, so I left, but I left my number. And by the time I got back to my parents' house, the phone rang and he said, were you serious about working for free? And I said, yeah, cause maybe I could learn some things from you. And he said, well, no, I'm going to pay you, but I can't pay you really what? And I said, great. And so he paid me $3 an hour, which was plenty of money for someone still living in their parents' house, right? And so I started working for him, and he needed the help because I would go through all of the applications and then pass on the manuscripts I felt, you know, was worthy of his, you know, sort of perusal. And then some.
You
were
an important set of eyes.
Mm-hmm.
You were right. Very important set of eyes. And
yeah.
And this was like the time frame would be, this was 1972.
Exactly. 1972. And then the Detroit board did call me and said they were going to hire me to teach at Cass Tech High School. And so that was really cool. And so I started working there as an emergency sub in a permanent position. So the pay was okay, but it wasn't what it would have been if I was hired, right? But I would come to Broadside after teaching in the afternoon. He was a librarian at the University of Detroit. So he would come on his lunch hour and he would come after work. And I would come after teaching and work in the afternoon. And then we worked on Saturdays. Okay, so, and then...
So you were living and breathing poems.
Yeah. And big time. Yeah, big time. I was.
And Black arts movement, because mm-hmm. people were, I feel like looking at the list, so many, everyone mm-hmm. came through there.
I can't think of, there's only a few people we didn't publish, and that was just because they were being published, you know, somewhere else. But I met everybody. I got to know people even from California who were in the Watts group. People like Jane Cortez, Quincy Troop, because we were all doing these readings. And then Dudley started really pushing me about me writing my poetry.
Let's talk about that. Thank goodness for Dudley.
Yeah, because, you know, I was intimidated by poetry. I knew I could write literary criticism and I could write prose, but I was always intimidated by poetry because it's the most difficult form. And so he asked me one day, do you write poetry? And I'm like, yeah, kind of, sort of. And so he said, well, let me see some. And so I brought in a few, and he took one. He said, this one's really, really quite good. And he made a few suggestions in terms of how I could tighten up the structure without interfering with my style, which is one of the things that he taught me, how to help the writer enhance their style, not to impose your what you think their style should be. So you have to understand structure very well. How are they using sonics? How are they using poetics? What is going on, and what is this particular writer's style? So
that's a special editor and a special skill to learn.
It is. It is. And I continue as an editor now at Wayne State University Press for the African American Life series. And one of the things that you don't want to do, and Dudley was also very strong about this, censorship. You don't tell writers what they should think, you know, but they have to be able to substantiate, you know, what their perspective is, what do they mean, how do they mean it, that kind of thing. So he was very strong about that. So there was no political censorship. He really believed in freedom of expression. So that was important. And since then, I've done some editing work with ML Liebler. We did a big fun book called Abandoned Automobile, Detroit City Poetry 2001, for the tricentennial of the city of Detroit. And
that's a massive book.
It is because we tried to cover as much as we could of the 20th century up to the going into the 21st century. And we missed one really cool poet. Oh man, I don't know how we missed Al Young, who was a Michigan poet, went to U of M actually, but he had transferred from Michigan to Berkeley, and he majored in Spanish there, and he stayed and eventually became the poet laureate of California. Okay. And finally, I did meet Al, and we got to be really good friends because we brought him in when we did the centennial celebration of the birth of Robert Hayden and Dudley Randall. Hayden, another very, very pivotal Detroit, Michigan poet also.
Yeah, professor here.
Yeah, Michigan. He was a poet, first Black poet laureate of the country.
Yes.
Unfortunately for me, he got that appointment when I was at Michigan, and I was all excited because I thought I was going to get to study with Robert Hayden. Oh. And as soon as I come here in 1976, he gets the appointment, and he's in Washington. Boo hoo! I was very.
You were happy for him, Melvo.
I was happy for him, but I was not happy for me.
Completely,
you know. And Dudley was very excited about me working, you know, studying with Robert Hayden because they were very close friends. But you know, that's okay. That's okay. I studied his work, and you know, I had Dudley, and also.
Did you ever meet him, Melba?
Oh, I did. It's a funny story, because. I was getting on the elevator in Haven Hall, going up to the English department. I don't remember exactly for what. And I was getting on the elevator. He was on the elevator. And I saw him and I screamed. I screamed his name. I said, Robert Hayden, oh my God. I scared the man to death. He started turning around trying to go through the wall.
Yeah, he just...
And I felt so bad. I said, oh, I'm so sorry. Because he was a very, fairly quiet, reserved, you know, personality. And I knew that from what, you know, folks had said about him and what I had read about him. And I said, oh, I'm so sorry. And I told him who I was and that I was Dudley's protege. And so he, fortunately, he calmed down.
Did he stay on the elevator, Melba?
only till we both got off at the end.
Yes, okay.
But I met him, and then subsequently I did get to hear him read at the Detroit Public Library in 1980, I think it was. No, before then. 78, I'm trying, yeah, because I was remember going, I was pregnant with my son. And I went to the library, another Detroit poet who was living in Frisco. He gave me a ride. He took me to the reading. Kanyas, he was a poetry editor at the Black Scholar. And it was amazing reading that he gave. And this was just, it was so cool. It was just really cool.
What makes a reading amazing for you? Because I know sound is so important for you when you're writing, when you're delivering a poem, when you're...
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, he was such a great poet. And for me, I like poetry that has both, you know, a sonic appeal as well as, you know, sound and imagery. Like, and a lot of writers, they're only interested in words or maybe meaning or maybe just imagery. But for me, I want both. I want both. And that was the kind of poet that Hayden was. Certainly was the kind of poet that Rhonda was. Sound is a big part of Black American poetry. It's a big part of it. And probably because I think the sort of pinnacle and also the origin of cultural expression in the Black American experience has been music. Because it was illegal to teach slaves to read. People were sneaking and doing it anyway, but so the poetry was initially out of the oral tradition, and so that was the first poems. You know, they would be recited and memorized, and you know, because you couldn't write them down, and really, what was in those poems, you probably didn't need to write it down because you'd get in big trouble, right? So, you know, they're talking about slave master, you know, and all that, how to run away, you know, what to look out for, you know, the North Star, blah, blah, blah. So the tradition comes from the oral tradition. Therefore, sound is such a critical part of it. And so that's what I love. You know, I'm not saying that the other is not valuable, but in terms of what moves me is, what was it? Bob Dylan said that Smokey Robinson was the greatest living poet mm-hmm. because of his song lyrics, mm-hmm. and he had his writing had a huge influence on my poetry as well, because of the lyricism and so forth. And I just
Smokey Robinson,
yeah, and the works that he was writing and so forth, because I could see what he was saying, and I learned and better understood similes and metaphors by listening to him than I ever did in the classroom, in high school. It's just like, you ever reading sort of traditional poems? And I'm like, they're all right. But yeah. I don't feel, you know, even when you could read the rhythm and stuff, and you'd be like, okay, but that's corny, you know. So,
but if you can feel it.
If you can feel it, yes. Exactly.
Then it's lifted.
Exactly.
Into the human experience beyond corny.
Exactly.
You can say anything.
Exactly.
Let's take a short break and then we'll come back.
Absolutely.
Today on Living Writers, Melba Joyce Boyd is here, Michigan Poet Laureate. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Jason behind the glass. We'll be back.
Say I'm loud, say I'm clear. for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means to be me. Then you'd see.
Welcome back. Today on Living Writers, Melba Joyce Boyd is here, Michigan Poet Laureate. Melba, thanks so much for coming down to the studio this afternoon and talking. And I feel like this is part one, so I can't wait for part two as well.
Okay, cool.
But we've still got half an hour. We've still got time. We've got time.
Yeah, sure.
So let's get to your poems some now.
Okay. This is the bicentennial for the birth of Frances Ellen Watkins Harper. She was a 19th century poet, and she was an abolitionist. She was a woman's rights advocate. She was a big supporter of public education. And she was also part of the temperance movement, which was big in the late 19th century. And was born in Baltimore, freeborn, and raised by an activist uncle. Her mother died. She was orphaned when she was 3 years old. Oh. And but she was educated. He had a school called the School for Negro Youth, I think it was called something like that. And her poetry is extremely important in terms of the evolution of a Black American literature, I think women's literature, because she was writing about those things. And she was, again, an example of how, in particular, Black American literature has been very much grounded in activism because of the struggle, first to get rid of slavery, second for equal rights, for women's rights, I mean, all of those things. And so she represents that. And I first read her, we were talking about Dudley Randall earlier, but the first time I read her was in his collection of books called The Black Poets, which was published in 1971 and when I was in grad school at Western Michigan. And so I knew who she was, but I had no idea how extensive her work was until I began doing more and more research. But in any case, her most famous poem is called Bury Me in a Free Land. And she wrote this poem when she thought she was going to die. She was a lecturer. She was an anti-slavery lecturer, and she went all over the northern states, Michigan. She spoke in Detroit several times, Ann Arbor, and into Canada, as far east as Toronto. So there's a collection that's going to come out for her, and I was asked to write an essay, which I did, but also they're publishing poems. And so I decided that I wanted to write this parody of Bury Me in a Free Land with a contemporary setting, as it were. And so it's called Scatter My Ashes Over Liberated Land. And it's always, I have to say, it's in a ballad. I had never written a ballad ever. I'm a free verse kind of jazz poetry kind of person. So it was a challenge to try to do this form. Scatter my ashes wherever you will, in the deepest valley atop the highest hill. Leave my remains in a remote, modest place, but not in a land full of oppression and hate. I could not rest or leave earth in peace if haunted by frantic cries and desperate pleas of young men of color fleeing deadly police terror while Proud Boys plot to assassinate our governor. I could not sleep beneath cold, roofless land where girls are enslaved and raped by any man. This brutal crime with disturbed tranquil air, my heart would grieve with pain and despair. I could not enter the pearly gates with ease while this nation believes in male supremacy, with laws and demanding women must give birth when death threatens and lessens their worth. How could my spirit take flight in gentle skies while a trail of tears runs through our lives, screaming children torn from arms of mothers, families tracked and trapped by border patrollers. Peace can't be still while homeless starve and suffer, cringing in huddles and dying in freezing weather. How could I forget this and transcend to blue heavens when the poor are forsaken with cold indifference? How could I depart when Putin's criminal president claims belief in King's dream at an inaugural event, then lies about civil rights and releases insurrectionists and excuses the Nazi salute of a billionaire fascist? Scatter my ashes over liberated land to replenish soil for trees emitting oxygen. Anywhere I can dance on the devil's grave, but not over land haunted by evil, oppressive hate.
Thank you, Melba.
Thank you.
Thank you. This poem is the latest poem you've written.
Yes.
This poem traverses so much time and yet is so precise in these present moments as well.
Yeah.
Of the pain.
Yeah, the challenges that we're facing right now. And also, those were the kind that her poem was about, the kinds of horrible things that were happening to, enslaved people in this country, you know, at that time. She wrote it in 1858.
Okay.
So, and it's just really sad that we're still looking at the violation of human rights in so many different forms. As you know, it's 2025. This is 200 years since she was born. And so, you know, it's was important for me, who's been influenced by Harper, her life, her work, to write a poem, you know. And it was a big challenge, believe me, it was a big challenge to do the ballad.
But you met that challenge with this ballad,
yeah,
Melba.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
So when you work, are you drafting, like, what is your process like with, like, we could, like, for example, with this mm-hmm. poem, with mm-hmm. the ballad, so of course the musicality, were you working out loud as well, or what is it like for you drafting?
Uh-huh. Well, I'm a trained musician from childhood. I studied clarinet. I used to sing in the glee club in high school, had music lessons. I mean, the training that we got in public schools decades ago was very expansive and also very progressive. So, you know, right now we're looking at a time where there was always art classes when I was growing up. There was always music classes. There were always these opportunities where you could pursue the arts, and that's just not the case now. Now you've got to, like, my daughter's an artist, and Maya, she does workshops in schools, and she's hired by different nonprofit groups and schools to come in and do things with children, but she's not a art teacher in a school on a regular basis. You feel me?
Yes.
So
that's where they're cutting the programs. Like,
everything
first for the public schools.
Everything. Everything is it's sad, and it used to be public education was valued, and you know, even universities I feel were more valued and got better support and were clearly more affordable. And so I was fortunate to have grown up at a time in Detroit when the public school system was actually one of the model systems really for the country. And at that time, realized that Detroit was very flush because of the automobile industry was peaking, and it's right after World War II, and so there's a lot of investment in education, all of that. And it's not the case now. It's just not the case. Things have just gone unfortunately backward.
Yeah. And teaching to tests instead of teaching to the human being, like experimenting and
exactly creativity.
Yes.
Humanities are being undermined by the current, administration. Arts are not valued in that sense. Even though I have to say that there's a lot of arts in the community. And a lot of museums, there's a lot of independent activity for artists and so forth. So the people have picked up, where it's dropped off. The problem is that the community has to be aware and of these activities. They have to have access. So it's not like when you're growing up and you always had an art teacher,
Right.
Or where I remember one of our things we used to do at the beginning of class with bell work would be, write a poem, things like that.
Yeah.
And that those things were valued. It wasn't just all about learning so when you graduated you could make a lot of money. It was balanced. It was, much more about developing American culture.
How do you see possibly your role as Michigan Poet Laureate in this, like in the coming years, because you'll have 3 years as Michigan Poet Laureate, right, Melba? Is that?
Well, it's actually sort of interesting because they had put a time limit. I think it was supposed to be like 2 years, but they decided they did not want to continue the appointments like that. And so minimally, I would serve for 2 years, but it's not closed. Like, if I want to continue, I can continue. I think the reason being that it takes a while to do all of the things that you want to do in that capacity. So, for example, I am doing readings, poetry readings in libraries and schools, and also working with other poets. Right now, we're talking about putting together some kind of a reading in the not-so-distant future. Myself and ML Liebler, with the Detroit Writers Guild, to have writers come out and to express their sort of angst. There's a lot of angst in especially in Detroit and Michigan right now. And even the university, my God, is under attack. So we're talking about let's get people out, to appreciate. And so also the thing is when I usually perform, if I can, I'll perform with the musicians. And so does ML. He's a singer. He's a poet. He's got a band, the Magic Poetry, So we combine the arts, and just like the sort of interdisciplinary nature. And I've worked not only with my daughter, but also with the sculptor Safel Gardner, who's an amazing sculptor and painter in Detroit. He's also the husband of Marion Hayden, the famous bass player. And so,
who you've also read poems with.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. And people can hear that. That's at the Kresge Eminent Artists site. You can hear the performance that we did. We did this poem. I read this poem at a celebration that we had this spring. And it was just so great because the musicians, they improved off of the rhythm of the ballad, but they're jazz musicians. So they took it to a whole nother space where like my head is. And at the end, Ian Finkelstein, he was on the keys. And he did this really crazy, crazy gospel shift, and it was just amazing. I just love that you know, artistic, you know, improvisational interplay. And Marion is a genius. And what she does is, like, she studies the poetry and she marks it and she comes up, you know, with the music. And then the musicians that I've worked with several occasions, they know me, they know my mood, they know my rhythms, and I know them. And so that way we're also, the audience really likes that. They like the intensity of it. They like the extension of it. And so when we did that, people were like, oh, my God, Ian just was doing it, you know. I said, yes, he was. But they're also very talented. And we love to brag on the fact that all of us went to Michigan. So we're all U of M artists. So
congrats. Oh, yeah, my gosh. So another quick go blue.
Yeah. We're big time blue. Yeah.
Melba, do you think then for, like, with the being the Michigan Poet Laureate, mm-hmm. might that be part of your project, like bringing, like, the overlay of music into the poetry readings or into
actually,
the same space?
Actually, I've been invited by Michigan State University, some writers and professors there, to come there this fall, probably in, I think, November is the time they want me to come. And so I asked, they want to do something in their atrium, or, you know, I've been to Michigan State a few times, and I said, well, if you want to do something, why don't we do the music thing too, and bring in, you know, Marion and the musicians. And so that's what's on the table right now. We're talking about, you know, doing a performance there. And then also, as part of my contract, I would also hold workshops with the writers on the campus, but it would also be open to the public to come. It wouldn't be limited to just MSU students. But yeah, those are kinds of activities I want to, you know, I'll be doing all over the state.
The UP too? When do you head up to the UP?
I don't know.
Nice to put you on the spot. Sorry.
I'm going to do the UP, but since I just really started doing gigs, like, in this past spring, I didn't want to go to the UP in the winter. I'm at Western Michigan in October, actually, for homecoming weekend. It's going to be fun because when I was undergrad, in fact, I was on Hell Week pledging Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority when King was killed. And they took us off Hell Week to go in for the demonstration, right? So I said, yeah, this is the real hell right here, what we're doing right now. And he and Dr. King had been an Alpha. He pledged Alpha Phi Alpha when he was at Morehouse. So it reinforced the importance and the mission of Black fraternities and sororities, which was all about, you know, helping the community, helping to move things forward. And so that, like, underlying that mission and that reason. So we're celebrating, the chapter there is celebrating our 60th anniversary and homecoming weekend. So folks coming in. So I told Western, when they asked me to come and do a reading, I said, can we do it homecoming weekend? Because, you know, a lot of folks that I went to college were going to be there, and our sorority sisters are going to be there. And many of them I haven't seen because they come from all over the country, right?
But what a community moment and a coming together.
Exactly, exactly.
And, of course, everyone's welcome as well.
Exactly. So I'm excited about that. And that's something that's being sponsored by the English department.
It sounds like you, University of Michigan, we better get you on your dance card at some point.
I've been doing, but you know, I've done readings here more recently. Did Juneteenth last year for Rackham College.
Right. Rackham,
in particular, Ethrem Brahmer, he's the associate dean there. And I know Ethrem, he used to be at Wayne State University. He was the co-director of Latino-Latin American Studies Center. So he has had me do some things on campus. And in fact, we did one of them. I did perform with, actually both of them, with Marion and musicians We did the Coe thing. Yeah, we did. So no, I've done things here more recently, and so it's always a lot going on, and you know, so.
I'm so glad you could make the time for today to get on your dance card for today.
But I am going to be, I also want to go into elementary schools and high schools.
Because
many years ago, there used to be a program where they had writers in the schools, state of Michigan. You know, in fact, right after I finished my degree at Michigan, and the schools would invite you to come, and I would do like elementary, high school. And you talk about writing, you do writing, they do their writing.
Well, like Inside Out in Detroit.
Exactly. Inside Out would be sort of an extension of that. And I've done work with Inside Out, obviously. Of course, I work with Naomi Lon Madgett with that and Terry Blackhawk. And so, no, I definitely want to do work with younger kids, not just at the university. Even in the elementary, I'm dying to do something in my grandson's school in Detroit.
Is that Maverick?
Yeah, that's Maverick. Yes.
Shout out to Maverick.
Yeah. And he loves drawing and he likes reading and he also likes all that techno stuff, but you know, but he's really into it. And I'm just really want to also inspire his friends, to write and to read, because a lot of young people are not reading. You can do both.
It sounds like you might even be thinking about doing a children's book with your daughter.
Actually, I had a children's story that was never published that I made up, that I would say, I literally would tell this story every night to get my son and my daughter to go to sleep. Because I turn the lights out, And then I would tell the story. It was called the Pumpkin Story, and it's all about a pumpkin who grew up in a carrot patch, and somebody noticed that. He goes, "What's wrong with your head?" You know, and so it's all about belonging, being different, and then he goes on a journey trying to figure out who he is, right? And it's a fun story. And I told Maya, I said, we need to do the pumpkin story, because it really does deal with, these kinds of issues about discrimination, acceptance, but also coming to appreciate yourself and defying, outside definitions of who you're supposed to be.
Melba Joyce Boyd, I am so happy that you are Michigan Poet Laureate.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks for being in the world and for your poems. And next time you're here, we're going to hear more of your poems. We've got, definitely more poems.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We'll do more of a reading now, but it's cool. It's cool because people can find my poetry at the site, the Kresge Eminent. There'll be poems posted also at the Library of Michigan. And so I'm working on my own website, because I didn't have my own website. So now I'm working on actually creating a website.
So that's coming soon.
That's coming soon,
and
yeah.
And also possibly a new manuscript is
absolutely
in the works here.
Yeah, I mean, it's been, I'm sorry, I keep doing this. I'm sorry. I keep doing that. I didn't realize that the sound reverberation. But no, I have the last book that I did, Deaf Dance of a Butterfly. It's 10 years. So
it's time. Mm-hmm. Michigan is so lucky to have you. Melba Joyce Boyd. I'm T. Hetzel. Thanks everyone out there for listening. And you too, Mom. Thanks everyone. Until next time.
Fats Waller and his London recording of Ain't Misbehavin' on today's program, Recorded in Europe.
Jazz Revisited.
Hello and welcome to the 21st century edition of Jazz Revisited. My name is DJ Tone, and it's my privilege to bring to you this show originally broadcast in 1967, now on WCBN FM Ann Arbor.
Jazz Revisited, a review of the first three decades of recorded American jazz, 1917 to 1947. The artists and their music. A program produced at the University of Michigan. And now, here is your host,